Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English debt.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, January 2nd, 2016. The first show of the year 20... Well, it's not actually a show, it's a production. But
first production of the year 2016.
The first radio program of The Personal Wealth Coach of 2016, which kind of really messed up my very professional radio voice there and... You know, the cadence and everything else.
It was only professional in your mind.
Right. But I am a legend in my own mind.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, I'm Jeff, and this guy over here is
Jake.
And we're both McClures. So that way you can tell us apart. I'm wearing plain. He wears plaid. I have a gray beard. Actually, it's almost white now, and his is kind of a dark brown. So. And the other thing you can tell between us is Jake has a handlebar mustache, which you can hear if you listen very carefully. You can actually hear his mustache rustling as he speaks.
I don't think it's called a handlebar mustache when you twirl it. What it is. Captain Hook?
The only thing I can think of is Snidely Whiplash, but that's neither here nor there because he used to twirl his mustache.
Foiled again. Yes. He liked aluminum.
He did?
Yeah. Constantly being foiled.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but there's other kind of foil besides aluminum.
That's true.
There's gold foil.
Now, that's more expensive.
Right. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, which we should disclose and claim is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm registered with the SEC in it's domiciled in Salado, Texas, although that we're here in Temple, Texas with a radio program by the same name. And we had the permission of the owners of that company in Salado because we are the owners of that company in Salado. And so we give ourselves permission to use the same title to the radio program as we do to the investment advisory firm, and that's not a coincidence.
Well, speak for yourself.
I did.
Yeah, I generally just say speak for yourself when most people do speak for themselves.
So what happened in the market this week, this year? And it's really interesting because what I really like... The Dow Jones Industrial Average did the same thing for the year as it did for the week. That's all we need to say.
Yeah, there's only one day.
Yeah.
Year-to-date returns are the same as the weekly returns, are the same as the...
But you're pretty close to the daily returns, you know. For whatever it's worth, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was actually... Let's see, 52 weeks was down 2.23% year-to-date, which obviously worked out to be the same thing, 2.23. For the week, it was only down 0.72. However, the S&P 500, this is where it gets interesting. This one we like to follow. For 2015, was down 0.73%, and for the week, was down 0.83%. Isn't that exciting?
Depends on the term. Exciting, just it seems like a minor blip in existence.
The day, the week, and the year... We're almost identical, and it continues. We continue with this great drama written by William Shakespeare, Much Ado About Nothing. And that's basically what happened in 2015. Or you can say, this is the first year since 2008.
You said 2016. No, you
2015.
Said 2016.
2015.
Okay.
This happened in 2015, right?
All right.
This is the first year since 2008 that the market has declined. That sounds impressive, doesn't it?
Well, I guess, and only if you don't know that that's a very short period of time.
Well,
it's like saying...
It's like, you know, 7 years.
On a Sunday morning, I haven't changed my socks all week. Well, the week just began.
Right,
you
exactly.
You haven't changed your socks all week. It's not the end of the day yet.
Right, and, I noticed... early in the morning on in the wee hours of the morning on as 2016 arrived here, I made the statement, I haven't slept at all this year. Anyway, what does all that mean in the large overall big scale of things? And the answer is not much. There's a lot happened in 2015, much of which was not forecast to happen. And very little happened that was forecast to happen, which tells you something about the future. The future is always uncertain. There's an awful lot of assumptions that we went into the into at least the economists and the hedge fund managers and people of that ilk went into 2015 with a lot of assumptions that turned out to be just wrong. The biggest one was about the cost of oil. I don't think I'm just beginning to understand, at least to have some vague idea of understanding what happened with the price of oil and why it behaved exactly the way it did. And oddly enough, the information came from a very strange source. Anyway, so what else happened? I mean, I can go into that, but that's going to be a little longer.
Here's a good one. The U.S. tuna fishing fleet in the Pacific.
Okay.
Seems like a strange thing to talk about.
That was a non segue, yes.
That was a non sequitur, which is a non segue.
Yes.
Except segues have become these strange things that people ride around.
It definitely was not a segue because nobody was riding around on it.
Right. So this is a non sequitur, but it is an important thing that happened this week. It's something I've actually been talking about this for several years to people as an example of economic thought and how it gets messed up so easily.
The tuna fleet in the Pacific.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
The U.S. tuna fleet.
The U.S. tuna fleet in the Pacific.
I'm waiting. I'm waiting with bated breath.
There's a treaty that covers tuna fishing in the Pacific.
Ah, okay.
A treaty that the United States signed 27 years ago. And it says there's 17 nations. They're the major tuna fishing nations in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And 27 years ago, some ecologists got together with some economists, so the ecos were covered on both areas. It's a very ecosystem.
It was very ecological.
Right. Ecologically, the economists said, hey, if we keep doing this, we've done this before, we're going to overfish and all the fish are going to be gone. Let's get everybody together and recognize that if we don't regulate this somehow, all the tuna fish will be gone. It's pretty measurable fact that there are a lot less tuna fish in the water than there used to be. And it was measurable before, it's measurable now.
And it worked with buffalo.
Right.
Right.
We know this is an effect that humans can have on situation when we like to eat tuna fish sandwiches, when we like to eat sushi, when we like to eat tuna in general.
So what happened with the tuna fish fleet, the U.S. tuna fish fleet in the Pacific?
Well, we and everyone else haven't been doing a very good job at regulating. So this group...
Wait a minute. Al Gore. There was no controlling authority in that
exactly.
area.
Exactly. There is a committee, sort of, that meets on this treaty.
Right.
There are 17 nations involved in this committee.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see any problems with that?
Particularly if every one of them has the right to veto what the committee does.
Pretty much, right. So. Well, they have...
Called
guidelines.
League of Nations.
Right. They have guidelines that they have to stay in and that you can't fish more than a certain amount. The issue is that we've been pegging that can't fish more than a certain amount every year.
Mm-hmm. Sure. That's what people do.
Right. We say, okay, this is the maximum. We shouldn't ever fish this much, but just in case, we'll set this maximum, and that's what we've been doing. Everybody's been doing
right. that. The emergency maximum.
This is what is called the plight of the commons.
Oh,
in economics.
I was waiting for you to say that.
And a very simple, you know, I've mentioned this on the air before, but a very simple recognition of this is if you have 10 cows and I have 10 cows and we have a plot of land and we're both using the same plot of land and it stops raining, well, we better get together and say how many cows do we want to leave on that land, or neither of us are going to have cows on that land next year.
Right.
Unfortunately, both through Dr. Nash's work in game theory and a whole bunch of other work in the plight of the commons. By the way, Janet Yellen's husband wrote a big chunk of work on the plight of the commons, and there's a lot of good stuff in there. But basically what happens is that we agree, okay, we're going to cut back on the cows. We'll each put 5 cows on there instead of 10 cows each, and that should help. But if one of us breaks that agreement, if one of us says, I'm going to put 20 cows on there, then the tendency is for the other one to put 20 cows on there too.
Or maybe put 30 on there.
Because you want to get as much as you can before it's all gone.
Mm-hmm.
And just as an example of that, using tuna, if I were to tell you, which is likely, the tuna fish is going to go up in price because the U.S. Pacific fishing fleet has to pay about $67 million to fish, and that's more than we've had to pay in the past. And so a lot of the fleet is not in service right now. They're not out there fishing.
Right.
If I'm to tell our listeners that tuna fish prices are going to go up, it is likely that our listeners will go out and buy tuna fish.
Which will cause
tuna fish prices to
right,
go up,
right.
Which will cause less tuna to be in the oceans.
Right.
So that is the plight of the commons. And it is our nature as humans to say, there's less of this. Well, let's get as much as we can before it's all gone. And that makes it go faster.
That's one of the failures of capitalism, and those who are true religious capitalists don't like it. But the fact is, it's a nice, simple cycle. The fewer tuna there are, the more scarce they get.
The more valuable they become demand is there.
The more valuable they become if people want tuna. And so the more people will attempt to capture and kill the tuna.
Because tuna tastes great. I love tuna.
And eventually, we effectively will run out of tuna.
Tuna is one of those things that we are really, 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 and I could say really a lot more, not very advanced in. We don't know how to do tuna farms. Salmon, we got it. Now, we've got wild salmon issues where we are killing all the wild salmon, but we're not going to run out of salmon because we can farm the salmon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, tuna are a little bigger than salmon.
Tuna and eel. Eels, we don't even know how they mate. We theorize that maybe it takes place in certain places out in the ocean, but we're not sure.
We should probably give the internet porn industry the mission of
the amount of time spent on that would work. The Japanese are really working on the eel problem, but the Japanese have spent over $1 billion so far trying to figure out how to get eels to mate. That could be a porn channel of its own.
That's what I'm trying to say.
So the same.
You tell the porn industry that there's $1 billion to be made in eel porn.
Right.
By showing pictures of eels mating to other eels.
It's a possibility in the future that we'll have something like the cowboys of the 1800s for tuna. Because we can't figure out how to get the tuna strong in captivity. And without the strength, their meat tastes horrible.
Oh.
And nobody wants to eat that. So the plight of the commons is it's far-reaching in every direction. We have a tendency to abuse ourselves if we're in competition with other people. Nash put that together very well, and there's something called the prisoner's dilemma, where if there's two people that committed a crime or maybe didn't commit a crime, but they're in custody, and they've been separated out. There's a mathematical formula that says, let me lay out the variables real quick. The mathematical formula comes off of these variables. The perfect scenario for the prisoners is that neither of them talk, because the evidence isn't there unless one of them opens their mouth. But if they're afraid that the other one is going to talk, then it's in their own best interest to talk first, so that they get the deal with the prosecutor or the sheriff or whatever it is, whoever it is that they're talking to, even if they didn't do the crime. So mathematically, the first person to talk gets the best deal, except that if neither of them talk, if they both cooperate, you get the absolute best deal. You get neither of them going to prison. And in the case of tuna, if everyone cooperates and everyone says, all right, this makes sense, we're only going to take this much tuna, the tuna keep living, we don't have price fluctuations, we have this good thing. That doesn't exist, though, because some nation out there goes, well, I'm gonna fish the maximum and I'll pay for it. That's fine. So all the other nations go, well, I'll fish the maximum as well and we'll all pay for it.
You mean it's kind of like if Congress and the president agree that we want to fight a war, but we have this thing called a balanced budget act
right
that says if we actually go to war and spend $1 trillion or so fighting a war.
We should pay for it.
We should raise taxes. We have to raise taxes or cut something else like Social Security.
Right. So we just make an emergency spending bill.
So what happens is the bill, the Balanced Budget Act, had a provision that in case of an unforeseen emergency,
right,
the money could be spent without offsetting because it was an emergency.
Yes.
And so each year, those of you who didn't know this, each year that we fought, this was under the Bush administration.
Well into the Obama administration.
Well, actually, in the Obama administration, they do something in the Obama administration. They actually put it in the budget in the Obama
administration. Yeah,
right.
The first couple of years they didn't.
But so the issue is that we kept fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as if they were sudden emergencies that had popped up, and initially they were.
Very long sudden emergencies.
I mean, the invasion of Afghanistan.
That was an emergency.
That was a legitimate emergency.
We've been attacked. Absolutely.
Once we established that we had an emergency,
we should put it in the budget at that point.
Except that it just kept being an unexpected emergency each year because we had a precedent now.
Right. And it's the plight of the commons again.
And we turned around and realized that we had spent a really stupendous quantity of money that we didn't have. And then the same people who had previously approved doing it off the books
said, look what you've done, even though they're the ones that voted on it.
Well, yeah, but that's because it was a different president from a different party in office now. So obviously it was bad what was good before.
Well, the other way around is true as well, and yes, that the people that were voting against it suddenly began voting for it.
Of course.
This is the plight of the commons.
And that's one of the problems is, of course, the commons includes the wealth of the American taxpayer.
Now, in the middle of that, we've just described the bad side of the plight of the commons. There's a good side, too.
There is. Okay, yeah. I want to hear this.
And the good side is what's just happened in oil. And that if we get really, really, really expensive oil, or tuna for that matter, we're going to spend a lot of money to figure out how to get tuna less expensively.
That's correct.
And what the Japanese are doing, what is happening with salmon fisheries, what's happening with vat-grown meat, where they're growing meat from stem cells, that is an alternative to the cost, because the costs associated with growing, for instance, a cow, beef, are very high. You've got methane costs, you've got costs to the environment, you've got costs to your bottom line, you've got all these costs that build up. And if you can find a better way of doing it, this is why I'm all about market solutions to so many of these things. If you can find a better way of doing it for cheaper, then do it, but you won't be able to ever get to that better way of doing it
until
the prices get high enough. Until that crisis is there. And what happened with oil getting up into the mid hundred,
$147 a barrel.
Almost $150 a barrel.
Right.
People looked around and said, hey, I bet I could do better than that.
This is why, by the way, if I had a choice, I wouldn't eliminate the bad guys. And the bad guys, by the way, include, in this case, hedge fund managers.
Right.
There's an article in...
Or attorneys, for that matter.
There was an article in... I don't even... Yeah, I think it was Financial... No. I just chased the article, and I think it was actually in CNN Money or something like that. But CNBC, that's where it was. I'm sorry. There was an article, CNBC today, about Cranmer, whatever his name is, the crazy guy that's on television who gives you lots of stock tips, most of which don't work. He's a pretty savvy guy, and he apparently ran a very successful hedge fund for quite a while before he decided to go into televised talking. And he makes more money on TV, by the way, than he made in the hedge fund, which should tell you something. This is the point about this. He couldn't figure out why, with demand falling and supply increasing in 2008, the price of oil jumped to $147 a barrel. It didn't make any sense from the market. From a pure market perspective, it made no sense at all. And he's using this as an example of why the stock market can be completely irrational for periods of time.
Yeah.
And it turned out, long after the fact, he figured this out, there were a bunch of hedge funds that in 2008 had predicted that the price of oil would fall dramatically because of the financial crisis.
Right.
And so what they did was they shorted the price of oil. Well, in shorting...
It didn't drop.
In shorting the price of oil, by the way, you sell shares in oil companies. You actually sell future contracts in oil. And it didn't drop as much as they thought. And what happened is they were forced to go back in and buy oil.
So this is called a naked short. They were selling contracts that they didn't own.
So they went back in and were buying oil to cover their shorts.
You got to cover your shorts when you're naked.
And all of them started stampeding to do it at the same time. Because once they started, the price started up.
Oil prices to go up.
Which caused the oil prices to peak. And the rest of the market, because these hedge funds are doing so very secretively, the rest of the market, the rest of the oil market, the people who control the traders who control actually the price of oil in as a group, not consciously, but just by their buying and selling, looked around and said, whoa, the price of oil is going up. Somebody must know something we don't know. So they started buying too. And the price of oil got up and stayed up even as demand was falling and supply was increasing.
Right.
And this continued for a period of time for the same reason.
This is a confusing piece.
Uh-huh.
Even as demand for use was falling,
mm-hmm.
people think that suddenly this isn't supply and demand anymore. No, the demand for use is different than the demand to buy for investments. It's still a demand to buy.
Right.
So the hedge funds and the other people following the hedge funds that didn't even know they were following the hedge funds.
Because the hedge funds are doing so very secretively.
Right. We're going in and buying and thinking that their purchase and the purchases of people like them were purchases for people who actually wanted to use the oil rather than people that were buying it to sell it to someone else. Mm-hmm. And this is very much like the real estate boom that led up to the recession, where people were buying houses and people were saying, wow, people are buying houses at such a fast rate. How can this be? Must be so many people want to have lots of houses to live in. And the reality was that they were buying houses so that they could sell it to somebody else who was going to buy it and then sell it to somebody else instead of living it.
There's actually a reason to this madness, though. This
yes.
is the interesting thing. Because back in 2004, some of you may remember or not remember, just before the presidential elections, and the Republicans at the time were crying foul that this was unfair, that the Democrats did this somehow. They didn't. The price of oil in the fall, about 2 months before the election, suddenly started rising and mm-hmm. rising very quickly. Specifically, the price of diesel started going up.
Right.
And the price of oil started going up. And it was a guy, Barclays Bank almost ceased to exist at that point.
Yeah.
Because the guy bet the wrong way. He saw the oil prices going up and couldn't figure out why. And he said, this is silly.
And it was silly. And so he just made a decision
actually,
too early.
It wasn't all that silly because what was happening is in China, there was something going on. They were converting
from coal to oil for a little bit.
And as a result, there was a shortage of electric power, so people were buying generators, and as they bought generators, they had
coal. Right, sorry.
Yeah, they had, and as they were buying generators, they had to buy diesel, and so there was a shortage of diesel because diesel is just a byproduct.
Yeah, we saw these amazing pictures at that point of huge warehouses, just crammed full of little portable generators.
Mm-hmm.
With lots and lots and lots of electric cords put through there and people running around in masks just keeping them fueled. And they were doing that to run factories.
This is the point.
Not very efficient.
Now we saw these pictures after the fact. Nobody knew why the oil price spiked at the time. Most of the traders and market speculators thought it was a false spike and didn't participate and got burned,
mm-hmm.
okay, like Barclays did.
Yeah.
Now, years later, when it comes around again, that was 2004. This is, and then when 2015 came around, or before that, about 2014, and the price of oil suddenly starts up. And actually, let me back up. It's 2008, like I said earlier. So what happens is 4 years later, the price of oil starts up again.
And they go, oh, we better get involved because this could be a great deal for us.
This obviously isn't because
let's not get burned again.
They got faked on the wrong side, so they went back the other way and said, obviously, this is real. We think it's fake, but it's real.
When you get burned once and then you get burned twice, that's called from the frying pan into the fire.
And there's a movie, which hopefully I will be seeing sometime this weekend, called The Big Short.
Yeah.
That I've read lots of reviews on at this point.
And it's about the housing market.
No, it's sort of about the housing market. It's about the mortgage bond market.
Right, mortgage bond market.
And the point is, the takeaway, if you get to watch it, and I would recommend it, even though I haven't seen it yet, based on all the reviews.
I'm not going to recommend it until I see it, because I feel like
it's got Brad.
The Wolf of Wall Street was the one people recommended. They said, it's great. You'll be able to see inside Wall Street. And I watched it, and I was like, no, that was a made-up world. That didn't exist.
This is the point. This is the takeaway from the people that I respect who've already seen it. The takeaway is not that there's a bunch of greedy people who are trying to make money from nothing.
That's duh. Everybody tries that.
It is that the people in Wall Street and in the Fed and in the government and everywhere else were very pig-headed. They refused to believe that excesses in the mortgage market could create a collapse. They
right.
refused to believe it because they
thought
had,
of it as a small part. Yeah.
They had never experienced it, therefore it could not happen. It's the black swan effect.
Yeah.
And
then, just as an example of that, for many years, mathematicians who had nothing else to do were talking about, they were counting the number of swans, as statisticians like to do, that sort of thing. So they were looking at swans, and they had never found a black swan, not once. There were legends of black swans where someone had said that they had seen a black swan, but it was never truly well recorded, and that was way back that they had the legend of the black swan. So they started using the black swan as an event that was impossible to happen, just simply cannot happen. And then they found Australia, which is plumb full of black swamps.
Actually, only a little place in North Australia.
Well, it's still a lot of black swans, and statistically that could happen. So if that had been the market would have collapsed. In this case, when we say black swan event, it's when a lot of very smart people get together and say, you're right, I have never seen it, so it must not exist.
Anyway, so what does that tell you about 2016? Now that we're in 2016, it tells you that the future is uncertain.
It's always uncertain.
But
Yogi Berra said it very well. The future is not what it used to be.
Right. He also said making predictions is really, really hard, particularly when they're about the future.
Correct.
So this is the point in the Cranmer article and in what we're trying to say here before we roll around and do commercials or something like that. There are fundamentals that will always be there. There are people who will say it is different this time, and particularly when the people who say it's different this time will usually follow that by this could go on forever, and those last two statements are just not true.
They're
a fundamental
scary
issue in the markets. Markets are in the long term driven by the economy. In the short term, by insanity. And unfortunately, for those people who have a shorter vision of the world, 1 year in the market is a very short term. 2 years is a short term.
Very short.
And as a result, the fact that whatever you had in your portfolio last year, if you were an investor, odds are it's worth less at the end, was worth less at the end of the year than it was at the beginning of the year.
And that's normal.
And if you happen to be owning a lot of gold in your portfolio,
it's worth a lot less.
Gold and oil seem to be pretty much in lockstep, down about 40%. We're going to break for commercials, and you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we'll be back on the other side, presuming that I can figure out how to work all the funny things on here. We'll be back on the other side after these important words from KTM sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we are people who definitely can say our names together. The telephone number's in here at KTEM on this Saturday, January 2nd, 2016. I've got to practice saying 2016. Are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. Once we're good at saying 2016,
mm-hmm.
it'll be 2017.
We're going to have to work on that. Actually, I think I'm already ready for 2016. I've been using 2016 in dates inadvertently. I've been
looking, that's just strange.
Yes, it is. I've been very much looking forward to 2016 for about 8 years now. Hey, there's a headline in Barron's today. The headline, the cover story in Barron's today says, which shows that even Barron's, which I respect Barron's quite a lot, can be full of BS and misleading information, because it says get 9% yield. How to get 9% yield.
There's a lot of that. In the financial world right now, there are a lot of ads, this time of year specifically, where they say things like, 8 stocks you can't beat for 2016, silliness like that.
So there, and it does reflect something, and that is that there are people who are reaching for yield who will do almost anything to get yield. In the same issue, though, there's this little comment about hedge funds that 264 of them shut down last year. You know, one mutual fund shut down last year. It didn't actually shut down. It just simply said, you can't get your money out until we liquidate a bunch of stuff, and we'll have it to you in about within the next 6 months. But it actually acted a lot like a hedge fund. Only one, but 264 hedge funds shut down. And when they shut down, it was interesting going through the list of what they'd done when they shut down. In most cases, what they had was a major loss. They returned the money to the investors, what was left of it.
And promptly started a new hedge fund.
Right, exactly. Which is sort of an interesting cycle, and a bunch of people then will jump in thinking that there's a get-rich-quick scheme. The less ridiculous but equally silly methodology is to chase yield. And to use as an example, the first stock, now actually the Barron's article talked about junk bonds, which are yielding 9% because the price is so low, because they're probably going to go out of money. But they didn't mention the fact that last year, while you were getting this, if you'd bought the same shares, the same junk bonds last year, and you'd gotten about a 7% yield, you'd have a negative return for the year that was really huge. And they say, well, hold to maturity. But the problem is that the junk bonds could easily cease to exist and be worth nothing at maturity. Now, here's the, when they got serious in the article, what they said is, companies like General Motors are a good purchase. They actually said this, because they have a 3% dividend yield, which they're covering through operations.
Right.
Sounds really good. Maybe we should go out and buy General Motors. Well, let me give you an example.
Well, the government thought so.
At the beginning of the year, they also had a 3% yield. The year-to-date net change in the price for 2015 for General Motors was down 2.6%. So had you gotten your 3% yield all year on your General Motors stock that you bought, and the stock price fell 2.6% for the year, your net would have been 0.4% taxable.
Ooh.
Now, but this is the interesting thing. The 0.4%, you pay taxes on the full 3%.
Oh, well, that doesn't sound like very much fun.
So if you're in, and it's not a capital gain, so if you're in the upper income brackets and you're trying to get a 3% return, you paid about 1% of the 3% to various forms of government income taxes. Okay, not in Texas, but elsewhere. Okay, so you paid about 1% out to the government. You kept 2%, and the price dropped 2.6%. And Barron's is saying that's a really good place to get income. But that is so typical, and this is the point I want to make. Long-term studies have cited over and over again, the higher the yield relative to the regular market,
the higher the risk.
A, the higher the risk, and B, the lower the long-term return. So when you get, when somebody, if a broker is trying to sell you, you should buy General Motors because it's got a 3% yield, or something to that effect, there's a reason General Motors has a yield higher than that of a treasury, of a 10-year, the 2-year treasury is up to almost 3% now.
Yeah, they like it when people own their stock and they want to give the yield to them. And
but there's a bigger reason. The reason General Motors, now we had record car sales in 2015.
Yeah.
So why didn't General Motors stock go up? There's the big question you need to ask
yourself.
Good question. And this is one of those things that Cranmer was mentioning. Common sense goes a long ways here. Why didn't the stock go up? The answer is Google. Actually, Alphabet.
Google's the search engine. Alphabet's the company that owns it now.
Right. The company that owns it, Alphabet, is in the midst of producing a technology that will totally destabilize the automobile industry, and we don't know how. But the people who look at this really, really seriously are saying horsewhips and regular automobiles, not horsewhips, buggy whips and regular automobiles are in the same general category. There's not going to be as many of them in the future as there were in the past.
People that are listening to this are probably a little skeptical. Let me give you an example that's much more recent.
Okay.
Nokia. Okay. Cell phones are a new technology. They are newer than automobiles. But automobiles are a relatively new technology, and we don't have a replacement for them yet. So the general consensus is that we're going to have our kids learning at age 16 to drive a car, and their kids will learn at age 16 mm-hmm. to drive a car, because that's what's happened for two generations now. So it's just kind of the normal thing. This is what you expect. Nokia thought that they were at the top of a maturing industry, that they were selling cell phones, and they were making the best cell phones out there. They were making telephones that played music when the phone rang. That was a big deal. I mean, think how long we've had telephones. First, we went telephones where you had to hit, you know, pick up the phone and talk to an operator to get a call, and then you had a telephone where you could actually dial your own number. That's pretty cool. Technology's advancing. Then we had technologies where you could hit buttons on it because the tone would go through rather than the stuttering sound. And then you had wireless telephones that you could walk around the house without the cord. And then you had cell phones where you could drive around the country. All of this, the cell phone functionality was pretty much the same as the telephone functionality, where the primary purpose of it was to speak audibly to other people. And then Apple said, well, I think we can combine this with another technology. We can combine it with a little portable baby computer thing. And you can listen to music, not just when people call you, but whenever you want. And you can browse the internet. And Nokia said, that's never going to catch on. Telephones have been around for a long time. We're the best telephone manufacturer. We're fine. Nokia is no longer the number one telephone manufacturer. Neither is Apple, unless you look at it in the sense of hardware and software combined. The market share is now completely new. The Koreans are a big part of it. The Japanese are a big part of it. The Americans are a big part of it. But it's a completely new technology. And the same thing is happening in cars right now. You have the old school cars where you say, we have a mature technology here. We have the most the best to fill in the blank, whether that is gas mileage or whatever, but we're still killing 30,000 people a year in car accidents. And Google, Alphabet, is saying we can do better. And in the process of saying that, a lot of other people are following suit. And Ford's looking around and going, we better get on board with this too. And Mercedes and BMW are saying, we better get involved. Tesla's come up with a completely new type of car. When I say completely new type of car, I'm lying, because the first cars were electric and steam. We're just moving away from the Ford model of internal combustion. So when people hear us talking about General Motors as being antiquated, it went through bankruptcy because of the first stuttering of the changes in the way we buy cars. And it's going to go through it again if it doesn't catch up and change the way it makes cars so that people aren't driving them anymore. And that was a lot of background to what you were saying about yield being a lot more dangerous in certain circumstances.
So, in essence, the lesson to take away from this is Jeff, and at least in my opinion, is that after a year in which particular people who are taking money from a portfolio saw a probable decline in their overall portfolio during the year, there is a powerful incentive to try to reach for yield, to to try to find some place that will use the term guaranteed and some level of yield, or to find this is a really great place to get a high yield. And the end result is very, very simple. If you reach for a higher yield than the broad market can provide, you are accepting a greater risk of principal loss, a much greater risk of long-term principal loss. For example, so how do you know what the market would provide? There is a simple way of doing this. It is, you look at the total stock market, and fortunately there are indices out there that do that, and as well as ETFs and mutual funds. So you look at that and you say, okay, the total, if you'd been invested in the total stock market of the United States for a year, you can get complicated and go overseas, you would be at 1 year up 0.4%. And that's the little stocks, the big stocks, the growth stocks, the value stocks, everything. Okay? Had you been invested for 1 year in the total bond market in the United States, which used to be purely hypothetical, but you can do this with at least theoretically with ETFs and so on right now, you'd be up 0.39%. So your total return for the year in a balanced portfolio where you mix stocks and bonds, if you had no expenses and you had weathered the ups and downs and you paid nobody anything, these are all hypothetical ways of doing it that never works, you'd be up about 0.4%, except for the fact you owe a lot of taxes on that at the end of the year. So the end result is it's a flat year. The markets were flat to down, both in bonds and stocks. This has been an unpleasant year, but this is where we begin to see the difference between the winners and the losers, in that if you stick with something that works and has worked for a very long period of time, and you're consistent and you look at the economics, this is a prelude to future gains. And I'm saying that very carefully. Historically, when we get a flat year, the odds of the next year having significant gains, if you want to play that, you know, if you simply want to look at statistics, are huge. The second aspect of this is knowing in the economy that we're in a transition. This was 2015 is probably the transition year between a recovery and an expansion in the economy. Transition years have a couple of things in common. Number one, the markets are typically flat. Number two, they're very volatile while remaining flat. Now, if you can think of any market, any place, any year,
violently stable,
where you had violent much ado about nothing, that was 2015. And that's the big thing that I really would like people to take away from what happened. I still say, this is Jeff again speaking, that we're very likely to see 2016 as the year when the United States economy starts hitting on all cylinders. The Federal Reserve seems to agree with us on that, in mm-hmm. that they intend to bring, by the end of 2016, their intent, apparently, is to bring short-term interest rates up to neutral, which means they say by the end of 2016, they expect the economy to be functioning in a normal fashion and not need life support. And I sincerely hope they're right. We've got some other things that we need to discuss, too, besides just these big pictures like Puerto Rico's default. And
right.
By the way, Puerto Rico defaulted while no one was looking.
Yes. Very small default, but they've got more coming.
Yeah, but it is a default, which means basically they didn't pay their bills. They owed people interest on bonds, and they said, well,
we're
not going to pay you. Bye.
And they've been warning about it. One of the issues here is that as a territory, or a state of the United States for that matter, there is no bankruptcy code. There's nothing that says, here's the order in which you pay people. There's nothing that says you need to take a certain amount of your existing income and allocate it towards your bill paying. We're going to forgive a certain amount. None of that is written. We don't have a system for nations or states, or territories for that matter, becoming bankrupt.
If you think about it, from a constitutional perspective, now, admittedly, Puerto Rico is not a state, it's a commonwealth, so it makes a lot.
Right.
By the way, for whatever it's worth, the next worst one is Illinois, and Illinois is in far better shape than Puerto Rico.
It's still not in good shape, but it's in a lot better shape than Puerto Rico.
When we look at Illinois, is it fixable? Yes. Is Puerto Rico fixable? No. They basically owe more interest than they have revenue, which is the classic definition of bankruptcy. But here's the point. In a bankruptcy, a court takes over the administration of the entity that's bankrupt.
Do you think a court will step in and take over Puerto Rico?
It's possible. Congress would have to pass a law authorizing it, and it might be challenged before the Supreme Court, saying under what, the Congress cannot federally take over a state. So they can't pass a law.
And under our Constitution, and the Constitution of Puerto Rico, for instance, the legislature is the one that sets taxation, not the court system. So if the court system steps in and says you owe money, so you need to raise taxes, well, the Constitution says the court can't raise taxes.
Well, actually, they can't raise taxes in Puerto Rico anyway.
Right. That's true.
Because they already did, and it caused a decline in revenue.
They're on the other end of the Laffer curve. It's causing all the high earners to leave.
Right.
It's happening in acceleration mode at this point. The doctors, engineers, attorneys, not that we really want the attorneys, but they're all leaving and coming to the mainland.
Well, I don't know. They're kind of going to New York and Florida. So that's
Send the attorneys to Florida. That's fine. We can, we're fine here without them.
So the issue is that, but this is the thing that is fascinating to me. Greece defaulted, by the way, in case you weren't looking. But they did so in a very orderly fashion.
Right.
And everybody agreed, okay. But there's no law that allows Greece to default, but they did anyway. And Puerto Rico has defaulted, and the Fed has raised interest rates. Now, I want you to think back to 2011 and a number of other time periods when any of these events, the thought that they might happen caused the market to drop around 10%. When they did happen, what did the market do? Nothing.
Or jumped slightly. And went upward slightly. What in the world?
But this is the other interesting thing. In all of that time period, when all of these fears of Greece or Puerto Rico or interest rates being raised to 0.25% or any of this other stuff was going on and the market was panicking, how many market panics did we have over the possibility that the price of oil might fall to $35 a barrel, which was the real threat?
Right.
But nobody saw the threat coming. So whatever people are afraid of,
it's generally not the thing that's actually going to hit us.
And whatever they're not afraid of,
that's the thing we should be afraid of.
That's going to bite us.
So let's just go around being afraid of things that we don't know about instead of afraid of things that we know about.
Cranmer made a very, very good statement that's tweetable.
I don't like Cranmer very much.
I don't like him very much either, but it was a great article. A lousy person can write a great article. He said, nobody ever made any money by panicking.
It's true.
All right. So you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. If you'd like to contact us off the air during the weekend, we have a voicemail. And during the week, we have people 947-1111.
Or 800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Or you can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.